She won't ask for it. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this very special event in the calendar of special events that the University of Oxford offers each year. I'm Ingrid Lunt, the acting principal of Green Templeton College. The college is privileged in the Trinity term of each year to welcome, as a visiting fellow, the Sanjaya Lal Visiting Professor. As many of you will know, Sanjaya Lal was the model of an engaged scholar who worried away to great and lasting effect about the deeper reasons why some economies fare better than others in our complex and highly interconnected world. He was Professor of Development Economics at Oxford and a Fellow of Green College up to his untimely death in 2005. The trustees of the Trust have admirably kept his flame alight through this highly imaginative post, which involves not just the college, but also a host department in the university. This year, it is, for obvious reasons, the Department of Economics. On behalf of us all, I would like to thank the trustees, and in particular Mrs. Rani Lal, the Department of Economics, and my colleagues in the college for all that they've done to make this evening's event possible. And I would also like to express our sincere appreciation to the generous supporters of the Trust. Professor Abhijit Banerjee is the fifth Sanjaya Lal Professor, and we are very honoured to host his visit here. The trustees have assembled a terrific panel to discuss the ideas of this year's panel event, and we extend a warm welcome to Nobel laureate Professor Roger Myerson and to Professor Vince Crawford from All Souls. To introduce them and to explain how this evening is planned, I'm delighted to hand you over to our chair, Professor Sir John Vickers, the Warden of All Souls.
Ingrid, thank you very much indeed to you and to the college for your involvement in this wonderful series. I'd like to say a word to begin about Sanjaya, whose career was, a 40-year teaching and research career in this university. I have very fond memories myself of Sanjaya. In the days before there was the Manor Road building, there was the Institute of Economics and Statistics in the St. Cross building. And I remember him very, very well from those days. Ingrid has referred to his great work in development economics, particularly on industrialization and technical change, with a very strong influence on policy and global organizations, whether connected with the World Bank or the United Nations or other very important organizations for development, were very much in his debt, and there is a tremendous intellectual legacy as well. He was also a man of extraordinary modesty and charm, and we all pay tribute to him. I think the trustees who have established this series of the visiting chair and the series of lectures and seminars in memory of Sanjaya have done an absolutely wonderful thing. Ingrid spoke about keeping the flame alight. I think it is, as this evening illustrates, it's burning with absolutely wonderful vigour, and I think this has been a huge success in its early years, which we are still in. I note it's so successful that last year's visiting professor, Paul Krugman, enjoyed it so much he's come back to be with us this evening. I don't know if that was explained to you, Abhijit. That's the way it works. So... Now, the way the evening is going to work, we have, I think, at most an hour and a half, so 90 minutes. If that were split, I think we'd 30 minutes for Abhijit's remarks, which will commence shortly, then I think Roger and Vince will each be 15 minutes or so is the target, and that should leave us at least 20 minutes, I hope longer, for questions and discussion. And the topic, which you see there, which is information voting and the quality of governance, is one that is extraordinarily rich, both in general, but particularly in the context of developing economies. So I'm very keen that we do have good time for questions and discussions, especially bearing in mind the wonderful calibre of the audience that is gathered here. I will introduce Roger and Vince very briefly when we come to their opening remarks. A brief few words about Abhijit, who is from MIT, is co-founder of the Abdul Latif Poverty Action Lab, and is one of the great development economists of our era, in all sorts of ways, but particularly through fascinating experimental work with, for example, Esther Duflo. The first time I encountered Abhijit was not, however, in the context of development economics. It was his sensational paper on herd behavior, paper on information theory, which I think is QJ92. And that strand, information theory, coming together with development economics, in a sense, the confluence of those two is what I understand at least part of this evening will be about. So we're the university as a whole, we're all absolutely delighted you are here with us for this term, Abhijit, and in particular that you're here this evening to introduce our topic. So let us welcome Abhijit Banerjee.
Thank you. That was very generous, John, and thank you very much to the Sanjay Lal Trust and to the Green Templeton College for hosting me. I'm delighted to be here. I was telling someone last night that this is going to be the longest I've spent in the United Kingdom since I was 3 and a half. So it's something that I'm very much looking forward to. I won't waste time because I think John was signaling that if I could go faster, it would be better. I'll try to go fast. So I think that this talk is motivated by, I think, a view of the world that I think is emerging and is becoming more and more powerful over the last some years, which is that somehow there's an enormous weight put on being informed citizens. And there's obviously the idea that voters need to make informed choices, but as well, I think there is the idea that parents should be vigilant about their schools, patients about their hospitals, citizens need to search out corruption and report it, communities need to figure out who are the deserving beneficiaries, and all of this is presumed on the idea that people are willing and able to be engaged citizens. I think this is not to be taken as given. I think that's sort of the starting point of, and it's neither the fact that people have the information nor that it is gets used, and I'll emphasize that distinction, I'll come back to that point in a bit, is to be taken as given, partly because people don't read newspapers, they don't read notice boards, but also they're busy, they're stressed, there are many things demanding their attention. It's not obvious that, that providing the public good of, figuring out who's cheating whom and how is what they want to be spending their time doing. And information, I think we often take as granted that information is sort of something that, it's like something you go to a shop and buy, but it's in a very important way not that. It's the demand for information is posited on having information. If you don't know what you want to know, then it's very hard to know it. And I'll give an example of that as we go through. And then the information has to be kind of internalized, processed, made sense of. And all of that makes this an enormously demanding pursuit, which I think there's at least in the policy conversation, we haven't emphasized enough. So I want to bring together, what I want to spend the time doing is mostly talk about a few experimental instances and then come back at the end to maybe wrap it into a little bit of a discussion of kind of theories that will help us understand this, and then what does that say about how to do policy in this world. So here's an experiment that, in a sense, the results shocked me. So this is a program that existed for 17 years in Indonesia since 1998. It's a rice subsidy program. Each eligible family is entitled to 15 kilos of rice at 1600 rupees per kilo. The price has been unchanged since 2007. When we did a survey, we discovered that only 30% of the households who were eligible for the program knew that they were eligible. They all believed that the price was 25% higher than it is. So you asked people, what do you think the price should be? And the price was usually something like 2,000 rupees rather than 1,600. So it was clear that very few people, despite the fact that the program had been around for a long time, the price had not been changed for a very long time, the sort of basic information to benefit from it wasn't there. And this is not, then maybe it's not surprising given that 84% of the eligible bought rice, but 67% of the ineligible got some rice too. 23% of the rice vanished. The average price people paid was almost 2,300 rupees when it's supposed to be 1,600. And what's I think most egregious is that they get about 5 kgs of rice when they're supposed to get 15. So this is the biggest subsidy program in Indonesia. We're not talking about a small program. Indonesia being a big country, this is one of the biggest subsidy programs in the world. So it is an enormous, enormous, enormous program with these are kind of slightly rather dismal results. Now, of course, the village leadership has no reason to keep people informed. I mean, it's in their interest to make it vague, so then they can, say that the rules are not what you think they are. And I think, and this is important, part of the way the program is designed makes it more complicated. So the government, for some reason, decided that they're going to pay for the rice, but not the cost of transporting the rice and distributing it. So it's always possible for the leader to say, look, yes, the rice costs this, but then it costs me so much to transport it. We calculated how much they it costs to distribute it, and the actual cost is about 42 times larger. So they weren't exactly sticking to the truth. Nevertheless, one would imagine that given what's at stake, which is an enormous amount, and these are poor people, this is their basic subsidy program, you would think that they would have the incentive to figure it out. And given that it's been there forever and ever and ever, you would think they would have figured it out. Now, one guess in that context is that it's basically people don't know because they know it's irrelevant. That it's basically it's a reflection of the kind of the power structures in the village, and it doesn't matter what you know, because the village head's word is the law, and therefore why bother finding out something given that you will never be, may never have any influence on the outcome. He'll just tell you what's going to happen. So now, to test that and other things, we did a field experiment in 572 villages with the Indonesian government, where the idea was give people information about the program, see what happens. So out of the 572 and 378 villages chosen by lottery, households received a Raskin card, a card which you see, which gives your name, what you're entitled to, and sometimes the price. I'll talk about why sometimes, but basically what you're entitled to and the price. So this is what this was mailed to every household. Turns out, not less than half the households got those cards because the village leadership could intervene to stop them from getting there, but still some people got those cards. Now if you look at that by itself increases. So don't know whether I said this, but or whether there was on a slide, but they were getting about a third of the subsidy they were supposed to get. That number goes up by a quarter when they get these cards. So just getting this card, which says essentially says, this many kilos, your name, and this is the price. On average, increases subsidies by a quarter. It's not the case that this rice was coming out of the pockets of the ineligible. It was basically, you know, the village leaders were surrendering more rice. So it was all good. No, you know, it's not that some people lost and some people won. Basically, you know. Now, even more striking, information matters in a very obvious sense. We randomized whether you would print the price on it. You print just the price, that number that's been fixed for 7 years, which, you know, should be paying every month, that doubles the subsidy. The effective subsidy is doubled by printing the... But on the other hand, it's very important to have the card. So if you give the card, the government wanted to see if they sent the cards only to the bottom 10% of the village, would that be good enough? Because maybe the information will spill out and therefore they don't have to. And turns out that's not true. If you get a card, you get a subsidy. If you don't get a card, you don't get a subsidy. So it's like, it's sort of mechanically, the possession of the card matters. And so if I put these two facts together, it seems like it's very important to be able to, not only to know, but to demonstrate that. So it's important to know, and it's important to be able to demonstrate that. The third fact, which it's also consistent with, is that if you make, so in another set of these villages, the information was made public in the sense that I was not only told that I'm entitled to it, there was a guy going around in a little vehicle announcing that, you know, the list is posted everywhere, the list was posted everywhere, and then go look up your name and you're entitled to it, to get it at this price and this much rice. So make it much more, the information shared, and that seems to have had a big effect, and the effect is much bigger than would be explained by the fact that people, you know, some people obviously learned about their own eligibility from that. But the effect is much bigger than that. So it's not just that people learned. It was important that they knew that other people knew. So it's the second order knowledge that seems to, that goes up. They know that other people know. And that seems to be important. That it's, that the effect is very large. The increase in the subsidy doubles as a result of that. So all of this is consistent, and I'll say in a sense why it's consistent in a minute, with another study that was done by Bjork, Reinick and Swenson in Uganda, where it's another kind of dramatic failure. So schools were supposed to get grants, block grants from the Ugandan government. The median school was getting 0% of that. What they did was they started publishing what the school is supposed to get. So instead of just sending the money and then it doesn't show up, they in the newspaper would say, you know, Oxford Grammar School to £2,000. So just a list of those things. That increased the median from 0 to 83%. So what I want to put, when I put together all of these things, what's striking about this is that it's not, the information is very basic, it's very simple. It's not, you know, if you weren't getting any money, why didn't you ask? Why didn't you complain? The information is not that it's sophisticated information. It's not that the information is hard to get. It's not that the power structures were so powerful that you couldn't, you know, alter anything. It was not that you were kind of, you know, they could just spit in the face of whoever had the information. Once the information was there, the money was surrendered. So it's not the case that it was somehow, you know, some reflection of a deeper political economy. It was simply the fact that people didn't seem to try to get the information that was easily available to them. And that's a fact that we keep coming back to, which is that there is a lot of information out there in the world which people don't use unless it's processed and made available to them. And that's in a particular way. And that's, and I want to, so one possible reason why that would be the case is that, you know, people don't like being wrong. We have some other evidence, I don't have the time to talk about it, suggesting that people really dislike telling other people things where they can be wrong. So they don't like, when they know that they can be wrong, so they don't want to say it. And one of the reasons could be that it's just they're afraid that if I'm the one person, if I go and I complain and I find out I'm the only person complaining, then it's then I feel vulnerable. Or it could be something more psychological. I just don't like the idea of being wrong. But somehow it's the fact that information is dispersed that disempowers people. And when they know that other people have that information and that it's precise, that it's written on a card, it matters very much that it's written on a card, even though, you know, people, the idea that, you know, these guys are making lots of money off you is not unknown. Everybody thinks that, but they don't want to act on it. Here's evidence that, you know, information without coordination, lots of information. We did a randomized control trial where we put a lot of effort in putting, giving out information, and it had, I'll tell you the answer already, it was absolutely no effect. So what was the intervention? This is a program in India. This is a very large education funding program. It's called the SSA. Under the SSA, villages have village education committees. The idea is that the village education committees will monitor the teaching, the education, quality of education in the schools, complain, requisition resources, all kinds of powers were given to the village education committee. Five years after the program was launched, we did a survey in the state of Uttar Pradesh, which is one of the biggest states in India. 92% of every village had a village education committee. We could find the names of the people on it, but 92% of villages didn't know it existed. If you ask the village people, track down the people who are members of that committee, well, a quarter didn't know they were members of the committee, but and the ones who were didn't know what their powers were. So clearly, somebody hadn't bothered to give them the information. More strikingly, we did an intervention where we put a lot of effort into telling the village education committee members both their rights and responsibilities, and sort of, this is, here's the name of the person to call if you have a complaint. And we gave them all that information. Simultaneously, the villagers were informed about the dismal state of education in these villages. Idea was that they would go and complain to the education committee, and the education committee would then act on it. And as a result, people knew more about the village education committee, but it had a precise zero effect on everything else. Every measure of activism, we have 10 measures of activism, spending, test scores, name it, and we have a measure and it doesn't change. Now, that didn't mean that people didn't do anything about it. The one thing they did was they started, in some villages, they were given some training and encouraged to start their own classes, which is a much more costly thing to do than to go to the village education committee and complain. And they did that. They started classes at a dramatic improvement in test scores. So it's not that they didn't do anything, they just didn't want to act collectively. The information didn't generate collective action. Now, I think cost of acting together, I think one of the things is that when information isn't very, very precise, there's always coordination failures, because I might not know what other people believe about this. Are they really willing to act on it? Are they willing to act on it a little bit? And that creates all kinds of possibility of coordination failures. Basically, we don't act because I don't know whether everyone else would act. I don't want to be the first person to act. One tentative piece of evidence that this is what the source of the problem is. There's a very similar intervention in Uganda that Bjorkman and Swenson did. Had massive, in the healthcare sector, but these were called the health unit maintenance committees, like the village education committees. They were village level committees. The one difference between the two was that the information campaign was accompanied by they appointed a civil society organization in every village to coordinate this. So not only here's the information, do something about it, but they gave people some resources to do something about it. And that was then a very successful intervention. So one, tentatively, I would say one piece of evidence that maybe it's coordination that's key in this is that it worked when you... Now, one place where individual action you might think would has potentially large effects is voting. Voting is different because you don't need other people to do what you're doing in principle, right? You don't have to act together. You go and press a button, you're done. And so we do find this evidence that information has big effects on voting. There's a very nice study by Faraz and Finan showing that mayors, so they randomly announce, mayors were audited in Brazil, and the result of the audits were announced in kind of over time, and the order was randomized so that, you know, some people got their results before the election, some people got it after the election. If you look at the people who got the results before the election and compared to the people who got it after the election, you see that the people who got it before the election get punished if their scores are, you know, 3 or 4, meaning corrupt, and actually gain votes if they score of 1. So there's I think, nice evidence on this. We did a study where even softer information, so tell people just how he does, has this guy done his job? Has he started a committee he's supposed to have started? You tell that and vote shares change. So you distribute newspapers. So it's not, again, people can affect voting. However, we did another field experiment in eastern Rajasthan where we actually managed to affect voting without giving any information. We just told them, this is important. Now, this is important. Do something about it. You should vote seriously. That's all we told them. This is important. These guys have a large budget. We didn't tell them what was happening in their village, so we gave them no information. It was just, we implemented a street play. Said, you know, you should take it seriously. And what's striking about that is that you see that the people who are affected by it, who lose out as a result of it, are the bad guys. We know who the bad guys are. We didn't tell them who the bad guys are. So these people must have known who the bad guys are. They just didn't do anything about it till they were told, do something about it. So in some sense, again, this could be either coordinated, and this is in a voting context. So again, the idea of coordination. Rogers has a beautiful paper showing that it, you know, with first past the post voting, coordination problems arise in voting. So again, if I'm pessimistic that anybody else will use the information, maybe I don't bother. So it needs that other people will use it. Otherwise, I can, you know, maybe I have other parochial concerns. If nobody's going to punish the bad guys, I might as well choose the bad guy who's from my particular social group rather than any other bad guy. So in other words, the availability of information is not enough. It's important that everybody is kind of using the information. Or people just don't, just thinking is costly. Now, I'll tell you one piece of evidence that thinking is costly before coming, I'm almost done. In Indonesia, we were looking for a way to find the poor. And the way we did that is getting the village community to rank people. So say that, you know, basically they were brought into a room and they were asked to, you know, they were given name card for everybody. And so they were asked, you know, given 2 names and said, John and Peter. Well, that's not what they were called in Indonesia, you might guess, but which of these is poorer? And then you put the one who's poorer on the left, the one who's less poor on the right, then you ask, now that we have Bill, is Bill between John and Peter? Is he to the right of John and Peter? Both? Is he left of both? And so on. And you rank them. So what's really, because we didn't want to have any bias in this process, we randomized the order in which the names were ranked. So some names got ranked early, some ranks. The whole process took about 2.5 hours. At the beginning of the process, the ranking is extraordinarily accurate. We have hard data on these people, so we can judge. By about the end of it, it's worse than random. So people just completely lose interest in this. So, you know, getting people to use information that they have, is not easy. Even if you know something, knowing that you know it, ordering it in your head, all of these things are costly. And I think we should therefore I think there's a lot of hope right now pinned on the idea that information exchange is important, but I think we need to really think about how to make those interventions effective. I would say there is two things. I'll sketch a little bit of the ideas here. So in particular, I've been doing some work thinking about why I don't think that the supply of these ideas will come from the kind of market for ideas. So it's not going to be the case that media will supply the right kind of processing of information. And there's, I think, some nice work by Muller, Nathan, and Schleifer on this. And we're doing some work on this, which is very much related to some important work that Vince did many years ago, showing that, you know, to be credible, information has to be coarse. And for that reason, it's not going to be information that will be usable by different constituencies. So to end, I want to just say that I think one of the other parts of the work that I do and many of my colleagues do is trying to understand now how to supply the right kind of information. What's the right kind of information? Some ideas are obvious. Like the information should be stable. If your program changes every month, it's very easy to cheat on those programs because, you know, your program is changing. So I can always say, no, that was last month's price. Now this month's price has gone up. So you need programs that need to be very stable. The information needs to be reliable. I think more importantly, it needs to be carefully curated. So you have to make choices. The idea that information processing is free and that we are going to rely on people to monitor every program. In India, there are 367 government programs. The idea that people are going to keep track of 367 of them is ludicrous. You'll have to pick two. If you wanted to get people to monitor, you better put your money on some things. It's really important to have, if you want to go down this route of, you know, citizen vigilance, you need to make the interesting question of that we are work. I think we don't know very much about as economists, and now we're doing some work about, is what does it mean to say the information is accessible? Because I think we have naive ideas about what's accessible, it's on social media or something, but those things have they're very clustered. Some people have access to it and others don't, and I pay attention to my friends, what my friends pay attention to, and so on. And so the structure of the networks matter enormously in the kind of information people get. And finally, I think this idea that I was mentioning, that common knowledge is important, that people is knowing that other people know is important, that's a very key part of it. I think it's important that I don't feel that I'm the only person who knows this. That's key to coordination. So with that, I'm going to now sit down and listen to Roger and Vince. Thank you.
So thank you very much indeed, Abhijit. Now we have Roger Myerson as the next speaker on the panel. So it's welcome indeed, welcome back, because it's I think only 18 months ago that Roger was here through Vince's good offices as the Humanitas visiting professor in economic thought. And it's wonderful to have you back. Now, Roger is from the University of Chicago. Before that was for many years just up the road from there at Northwestern. In 2007, he was winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics, along with Maskin and Hurwitz. And
I'll keep going while this is fixed. Roger's work, for which he won that prize, was again about the economics and political science of information. It was about the mechanism design, which is the question, the very general question, of how to design rules, organizations, frameworks to deal with the ubiquitous situations in which there are various players with their own information and their own incentives. Classic cases of this are things like bargaining and auctions. And Roger was, in a sense, one of the inventors of a magic key called the revelation principle, which unlocks a whole class of these problems. He's going to speak this evening about local agency costs and political centralisation. And Roger, the floor is yours.
Thank you. It's great to be able to follow and speak in honour of Abhijit, of your visiting professorship here at this wonderful institution. And to be able to come back I love your title, Abhijit. Information Voting and the Quality of Governance could have been the title of this paper, and I'm proud to be advertising. This was a paper that I advertised, I speculated about a year and a half ago, and now it exists. But today I just want to sketch a little bit about it and put it in counterpoint. I believe in the importance of local government in particular, of decentralized democracy. I think one of the most important papers in economics in the last several decades is Abhijit's paper with Lakshmi Iyer on the significance of local governance structures, showing that feudal local governance structures in India that were instituted because they were convenient for implementing foreign rule have had deeply destructive effects on economically costly effects. Showing the enormous importance of local power structures, and I believe this is meant to be a model. Let's say we're talking about information voting and the quality of governance. I want to talk about, most importantly, thinking about how should we think about information, because I want to take these ideas in maybe the opposite direction. Abhijit just spoke about conveying information to the poor about their entitlements. This is obviously important. I want to talk about getting information from poor citizens about the evaluation of the local officials who serve them. We could talk about the ignorance of poor voters. I should say I'm a rational choice theorist, and so when I say people are ignorant, that doesn't mean they're stupid. They have rational expectations whenever I approach anything, at least at my thinking of things. So what do they? Poor voters don't know something, but there's ignorance of national elites. They don't know the quality of public services in remote communities, and perhaps they don't care very much about it. I've got a question here in my slides, and the answer is yes, both. Should we model problems of getting information to identify good policies? I think most of the good informational political economics papers are of that form. But I want to argue we should also be thinking about the problems of getting information to deter moral hazard in public spending. To evaluate the performance of local government officials in remote communities in poor countries, local residents' information may be essential. I note here a literacy for power that I believe that some of the poorest people in poor communities of the world are people who, I'm going to call them politically illiterate, which may be different from illiterate in general, but not. One must understand how to express one's grievances effectively. If people think you just always complain, it doesn't work. If you don't know who to talk to, if you don't know in what language to explain. And certainly people who are illiterate, who cannot read and write in the language of their government of their country, their political voice will be weakened. But I want to argue when the quality of local public services can be observed only by local residents, the national leaders are going to be unable to hold responsible officials accountable for this quality unless they somehow effectively give local residents some effective power over the officials who are administering these programs. To me, political decentralization means guaranteeing constitutionally, whatever that means, and I can say what that means, but means creating national political guarantees that the local communities have power to punish local officials who administer the power of government in their communities. That is the meaning of political decentralization. Without such guarantees, if you don't have political guarantees that constitute political decentralization, within my model, I'm going to assume that national leaders are capable of polling and getting information. They just don't have to use it if they don't want to. And they may have many reasons to want to do other things. So obviously, without such guarantees, local officials' careers may depend more on their national political relationships than on the quality of their public service. And therefore, we should expect to see communities where public services are inadequate, that money that goes in isn't actually spent for the benefit, and such failure to ensure good public services can then deter valuable private investments that depend on public infrastructure. In successful societies of Europe and North America, private investment depends on public infrastructure. I'm sorry, in America, I would say Republicans ought to take note to that position. A Chicago economist knows that private investment depends on public investments that create the infrastructure of transportation, of local justice, of property rights and contract that are essential for economic development. The private investments that are essential for economic development depend on private citizens being able to rely on the quality of public services, and where the monitoring of local public services is weak because of excessive political centralization. And I'm certainly thinking of Africa as a continent has the most politically central, statistically the most politically centralized countries, the least political decentralization in general. That the poverty of many countries in Africa can be understood. I should say, by the way, in responding more, I think some of the studies of decentralized government question, for example, whether decentralized government provides better services by looking at the targeting of the poor. I would ask whether targeting benefits to the poorest in a community is a local public good. I think targeting benefits to the poorest members of a community in India is a global public good. It's something that we care about in Oxford and in the World Bank and other places. But I'm not sure that the median voter in these communities cares about that as much as public goods being better road systems, better protection of place to do business. Okay, I'm going to have to skip because time is short. I have another paper on local, the whole other, but let me stay away from that. So the basic argument I want to make then is that democratic decentralization can provide better mechanisms for local public investments that can be essential for economic development. An agent who manages public resources, if we're going to talk about moral hazard, I want to talk about moral hazard rents. An agent who manages public resources must expect greater long-term rewards from using them appropriately to serve the public than from misappropriating them. So when I want to make a model of this to crystallize our thinking about the problem, it's a model where the obvious model is that there's a public budget and one administrator or one coherent administrative team has to control a large amount of public resources, whether they're given by the national government, national government resources, the local resources, or by the World Bank. It's still somebody's got to control these resources, and they can run away with them. They can run away, and so I'm going to assume that they can run away with them. Therefore, their benefits from using these, they can run away to a foreign country where they'll be immune from prosecution. So they have to do better. You can't have people running major well-financed, you can't have people controlling public budgets while they're going home hungry at night. They have to be well paid. So we need to, but on the other hand, we understand from the theory of moral hazard that the most economical way to provide incentives is by what we call backloaded late career moral hazard rents. That is, that a lifetime of good service brings long-term rewards. But if only local residents can observe the quality of the local public services that these budgets, this public budget is to finance, the agent has to expect that their future rewards will depend on local residents' approval. That means national leaders have to cede some control over these offices in a constitutionally centralized country. I should say this country, England, has been constitutionally decentralized basically since the time of Edward III and much of the welfare of England, and certainly the era of the Turnpike Trusts in the 1700s. The Industrial Revolution, the framework for the Industrial Revolution, is built by the sharing of power through the institution of Parliament that enabled local elites to build the greatest road network of the world then in England in the 1700s. But in a centralized country, national leaders must cede some control, even though the moral hazard rents make, of course, them unwilling to cede control. They want to use these if there's no constitutional reason for them, prior constitutional a requirement to decentralize, national leaders want, of course, to appoint to use these rewards, use these positions, which are going to earn large moral hazard rents, as rewards for their valued political supporters. Political decentralization means guaranteeing local power to punish local officials. I want to cite the Fortman report, Louise Fortman's report to the government of Botswana, that I believe should be recognized as an almost forgotten classic of development, where she argues beautifully, I think, that a poor community, even without the World Bank's help, a poor community can mobilize its resources for public investments that will improve the welfare of the community, but only when members of the community are coordinated by local leaders whom they can trust. The community has to be able to trust that these people will use the resources appropriately. The community has to trust that these people will use their power to discipline free riders and to appropriately reward contributors to the public project. But such trust can be expected only when leaders have authority that's based on local politics. Local officials whose positions depend on national political patronage are inevitably more concerned about their national political relations and less concerned about their maintaining trust of members of a small, poor community. So that I want to argue that a national... Louise Fortman also argues that the national government's promise to match local resources she found in Botswana was less credible when local community leaders have no voice in national politics. And I love her quote, where she says that she observes that those leaders who truly have followers in the communities of Botswana that she studies, who are trusted by their followers, have weak links to the government, and those people who have strong links to the government are not trusted by anybody in the villages. We're in a math building, but I promised John Vicks that I would be short, so I'm not going to discuss the model. The obvious, I want to at least say, what's the obvious way to build a model? The answer is there's this public good that, first of all, I want to say that the guy who, where's it say, the three things are bolded. The budget for the local public services must be managed by a local official who can divert in any portion of it to her personal consumption, or can even flee with the money abroad, 1 year's budget abroad. What if she spends it correctly, what happens? Well, the more she spends, the more the official spends, the greater is this number pi of the G is the amount spent per person, not just budgeted, but actually spent by the official. And the more that's spent, the greater is the probability that a residents make a big investment first, a one-time investment, if they trust that they're going to get good public services. And then in this model, the more that's spent in any given year, the greater is the probability that they'll get a success from their enterprise. The only evidence of the official's actual spending in this idealized model is the binomial random variable, which is the number of successes if they're n residents, and each one has a pi probability of success, if pi of g if g is spent. And that binomial random variable is if n is a large number, there's very little variance, it's a very accurate signal, but it's the only signal we have of how much is actually spent. So now you must poll the individuals. You don't have to actually poll all of them, but you have to pull a lot of them to if you're going to give the if you're going to invent any incentive system to encourage the official to manage the to not steal the money. There's a problem now. Can an autocrat be a neutral judge of local officials' public services if the autocrat is of course going to use these, since there are moral hazard rents associated with the office? These are well-paid offices because of the opportunity to steal money. They have to be well-paid, and if the autocrat, if a centralized ruler controls it, then the centralized ruler would like to pay them to use them as rewards. I'll skip that. I can't show you how we model the centralized autocracy. I can't show you, there, I can show you, but not say anything about how I modelized centralized democracy. In centralized democracy, the proposition, and this kind of looks a lot like Ukraine, is that in an equilibrium of these two candidates, and they can decide whether to promise that they'll make local government in each district accountable to the voters there. Let's say that in a campaign, I can make a credible promise to make your that when I'm in charge and I appoint people to run the government in the local government in your district, that I'll really listen to you. Or I can make a credible promise to sell the office to somebody else to the highest bidder in exchange for campaign contributions that I can then spend to make ads that get some people to vote for me. And in an equilibrium, what the candidates do is they make some promises in some districts, and in other districts they just sell to the highest bidder. And in a little numerical model, about the winning candidate sells about a third of the provinces to the highest bidder, and maybe they secede and want to join Putin's Russia. Anyway, so what I want to say is that I was trying to articulate it, because we're in a math building, I felt I had to. A model of moral hazard in public services, which could be efficiently managed if the officials were locally accountable, but in a centralized autocracy, the local residents who can observe the quality of the local public good may be unable to communicate their complaints to the elite who must approve any decision to dismiss the responsibility. The important thing is that a ruler who can resell vacant offices is not a neutral judge of the performance of the people who he has just appointed as rewards. Without political decentralization, even in a unitary state, national leaders may choose. Even though the voters would like to be promised good government, a good campaign also needs campaign contributions, and so a unitary state will not decentralize as efficiently as well as one that is decentralized. And in any case, there's this profound vested interest. Decentralization is undersupplied in the world. We should expect decentralization to be undersupplied in the world because it is not in the interests of those who hold power at the national level. They would prefer to hold more power themselves. However, federal democracy can become stable once it's established, as elected governors and mayors and county councillors become vital local power brokers in building national coalitions. The founders of the United States of America, in particular from the colonial experience, had to accept substantial decentralization in the new nation in 1789, because autonomous local governments under English colonial rule had been established 100 years earlier. And since then, I think in the United States, and as I've said, in this country and in the Great Britain, democratic local governments have overseen public investments that provided the basic framework for the richest nation on earth.
Next, we have Vince Crawford. Abhijit mentioned village committees, and early this afternoon, Vince and I were at a meeting of the All Souls College Domestic Committee discussing, not making this up, among other things, light bulbs. Now, in case you wonder how many fellows of All Souls it takes to... I don't want to go there. Instead, we're going to hear Vince's comments on the topics we've been discussing. Now, Vince's work, again, as with the others, is incredibly broad-ranging. A lot of it is would come under the umbrella of game theory, particularly behavioural game theory. But Vince is very famous for a paper some while ago on strategic transmission of information. So again, it's very much within the theme of the other presentations we've had. And we look forward to it very much, Vince.
Thank you very much, John. It's a great honor to be here. I did not have the wit to move to Oxford soon enough to meet Professor Lal, but it's very gratifying to see his work carried on so beautifully with the help of Green Templeman and especially Mrs. Ronnie Lal. It's also a great honor to follow these guys who are pros in political economy and development. I, as you'll see shortly, am not. I'm an amateur who sometimes thinks about these issues, but particularly since I know relatively little about development economics, I'm going to focus on sketching out some ideas that bring the kind of research agenda that Abhijit has been conducting in developing countries to Western democracies. So I'm not sure how easy it is to get permission to experiment in electoral politics in the UK and the US. I think some things are possible. I would like, though, to sort of try to prod people to do a little bit more research in this area because, very roughly speaking, I think there are some deep problems with the electoral processes in the UK and the US, and one hopes that economists could help attenuate them a little bit. Anyway, so the basic ideas here, I think, as usual, I've gotten ahead of myself and said almost everything on the first slide. Let me move ahead. Let me just sketch quickly some ways in which the UK and the US politics differ from those of developing countries. Clearly, aggregation of information is equally important, and attention is still a severely limited resource, and the information problems that voters face are just as difficult. But literacy is close to universal. Media coverage is too all-pervasive by our experience, and there's no shortage of people telling voters how they should interpret the facts. As a result of this, politicians who are grossly malfeasant or even who have gross personality difficulties or are quoted saying offensive things get weeded out very quickly. And what's left creates a different political landscape than the one that Abhijit was describing and the one that Roger was describing. So how can we think about how elections aggregate voters' information about quality of governments in developed economies? And I start with one of the old favorite quotes from Keynes, which you've already seen, so you could just read the first two words and fill in the rest of it by yourself. The idea that markets should aggregate information efficiently, it's interesting to start by tracing that idea back and trying to identify the models that lead to it, and then in the usual taxonomic way of economic theory to try to figure out how real economies differ from that as a way of getting some insight into what goes wrong. And you may decide for yourself whether the next paragraph on the US Supreme Court appears on the same page as the word madmen by accident or not. I don't want to be sued, so I will not tell you. But anyway, when you see a decision like Citizens United, which basically opens up political spending with very few limits, as it does in the U.S., and there still are some limits in the U.K., as I understand, but there's always a danger. You have to wonder what kind of thinking leads rational people to make that kind of decision. What kind of thinking would lead people to think that unlimited spending could possibly be a good thing for information aggregation? And down at the bottom, I just outlined some simple assumptions that help to start thinking about this, obviously not to finish. But basically, I'm not going to distinguish between candidates and the parties that they represent, and I'm not going to focus on the process by which results in individual constituencies determine who wins prime ministership or presidency, but rather focus on a model in which politicians choose positions or platforms to try to maximize the probability of winning, which roughly speaking reduces to maximizing the swing in favor of their party. Couple of things. first model that you think of in this context is a one-dimensional model made famous by Anthony Downs and Harold Hotelling, which is basically a model of politicians choosing and committing to platforms in an attempt to attract voters and win the election, when every voter is sort of arrayed along a one-dimensional left-right array of views. And the famous theorem there, which is also a theorem in industrial organization, but which appears in the political context in a famous book by Downs called An Economic Theory of Democracy, is that competition will lead two-party candidates to converge to the center, in particular to converge to the platform most favored by the median voter. And you can elaborate this argument under some additional assumptions, I think, to show that in a multidimensional setting, if voters are still arrayable along one dimension, there's still a convergence result, and it still has the effect that people don't take obviously inefficient platforms. So obviously, when we compare that result to the world, we see very different things. And the next things I want to do is basically give you a catalog of reasons why things might be different. I also call your attention to modern papers by people like Feddersen and Pessendorfer, which basically do the same kind of analysis in a much more elaborate, game-theoretically detailed way. So at the bottom, I basically list the obvious differences between that prediction and what happens in the UK and the US in modern politics. And I want to focus on two things here, given the time. And I forget when I started, but I'm sure John will tell me. I want to focus on strategic models of communication, as Abhijit referred to, and also sketch some brief insights or possible potential insights from models of agency. And here you have a wonderful quotation from Larry Summers that basically says, yes, information that's dispersed in the economy is highly relevant to the outcome. We wouldn't want to ignore it. But the people who have the information also always care in different ways about how it's going to be used. That's the first time I've ever tried to paraphrase Larry Summers, but you can read the quote and get the original. And let's just imagine focusing in on a single relationship, say, between an individual voter and a candidate, and imagine that the individual voter is somebody who knows something important to the candidate, for instance, the effect of austerity on unemployment, and he's trying to credibly convey this information to the candidate. Or you could flip the model and imagine that the candidate is trying to convince the voter that the candidate is going to take a responsible position on an issue that the voter cares about. Could also be austerity. And there are two key cases to distinguish. One, the case where the messages that the voter sends to the candidate or vice versa are verifiable, and secondly, that they're unverifiable. Verifiable messages are studied by Grossman and Milgram in famous papers where preferences are ordered in a particular way and the information is one-dimensional. And the basic result there, I ask you to imagine the macroeconomist saying what the effect on unemployment would be, in the sense that he makes a report which is allowed to be vague but is not allowed to be false. And I ask you to assume, for the sake of argument, that the macroeconomist knows exactly what the effect, and implicitly here I'm treating austerity as a 0-1 thing just for rhetorical simplicity. And the expert can send a message of the form, austerity will raise unemployment by at least X percentage points. The Grossman-Milgram result here in this context guarantees accurate transmission of information. It's not, he can't lie, he can't make it higher than he wants, and it's not optimal for him to make it lower than he wants to say. And therefore you get credible transmission of information. That's an extremely fragile result. If you elaborate it in any one of the 40 different ways that you can think of, it breaks down. And therefore, even with verifiable information, there's no presumption that the information will be aggregated efficiently. Turning to the other case, one which Crawford and Sobel studied a long time ago, the one that Abhijit referred to and that John referred to, unverifiable messages, what are called now cheap talk. We actually tried, we thought about calling it that initially. We decided not to. We didn't realize that we couldn't control the profession's language, so now we knuckle under and call it cheap talk ourselves. In any case, you're allowed to lie. It's not checkable. You're also allowed to be intentionally vague. And very roughly speaking, the result that we got is that the amount of information that can be credibly transmitted is sharply limited by the difference between people's interests. So if the voter and the candidate have different preferences about how the information that the voter has is going to be used, they can't convey the information perfectly. They can only convey the information noisily. And the degree of noise that's necessary in equilibrium goes up with the difference in their preferences. In particular, if you're trying to talk to a candidate whose goals are completely opposed to yours, it doesn't take an equilibrium game theorist to show that, no information can be transmitted. In any case, there are lots of things wrong with this. Joel and I were dissatisfied with the fact that it didn't have a clear view of lying. We've tried to fix that in a number of ways, and those are mentioned at the bottom of the slides, which I expect eventually will probably be no, I can't. Okay, so there we are. All right. So other complications that I think are highly relevant is political speech is mostly public. Therefore, it has to be heard by different audiences, and you have to be very careful to say things that will be understood in the right way by all the different audiences. That sometimes requires delicacy, which we don't have very good models of, but there's a wonderful paper by Glenn Lowry and a wonderful paper by Stephen Morris that I cite here, which will give you a start at thinking about that. In the model of political competition that I sketched, there's no history, there's no landscape, yet in reality, parties are heavily constrained by their past history and by their association with particular bases, as I sketch in the sort of quotes, example quotes in the next paragraph. Finally, messages can bundle dimensions. So one puzzle in the U.S. is why do poor and middle-class people vote Republican when the Republicans are basically only interested in the welfare of billionaires? And the answer, I think, is partly that the Republican Party successfully bundles social issues on which the middle class agree with them, with economic issues on which a sophisticated middle class would very much not agree with them. Those things are not well understood, but they can be better understood by focusing on models with limited attention, and I give you a couple of readings there that'll help you get going, including the Mulanathan, Schleifer, and Schwarzstein paper that Abhijit mentioned, I believe, in the QJE 2008, and a wonderful paper by Xavier Gabex and David Lapson in the 2006 AER. Finally, there's also a lot of information and disinformation, and there are great mysteries, like how did John Kerry, who had a stellar military record, manage to lose to people who were either draft dodgers who often didn't show up to work? And I assume that they can't get at me anymore, but Dick Cheney and George W. Bush have some explaining to do about that. And it's very interesting to study the rhetorical ploys by which that was accomplished. Fact-checking is not a panacea. And agency. Very quick. How many minutes do I have? How many seconds do I have left?
Say 1 minute.
Okay, 1 minute. No problem. So agency models. I think the political landscape is very complex. I think the important actors are candidates or parties, political consultants, billionaires, and voters. There are agency relationships between each of them. What economists mean by agency relationship is one party has some information that's relevant to the other party but not shared by the other party. The other party hires the first party to do something with the first party's information, but their interests are not aligned. So the agency relationship doesn't yield an outcome that's optimal for either of them, but rather a compromise. There are some very strange things going on in modern politics involving relationships between people like political consultants and billionaires. I won't name names because those people will sue me. And the media and voters. There's some very interesting work on the role of media in political competition, which I cite in the second to last paragraph down there. And some things that I might have thought were true of media in political competition are actually not true. For instance, networks like Fox News, as Genscow and Shapiro have sort of shown in other contexts, might actually just be maximizing profits, and they find it profitable to appeal to a conservative base, even if they don't care about the ideological goals of the conservative base, just a consequence of market competition, something that people implicitly think is going to be good for information aggregation, leads to and contributes to the polarization of political discourse. So those are just a very few things that will give you a start in thinking about this stuff and maybe give us a basis for some back and forth in the question and answer session. Thank you.
Thank you. Our time is up. There is a drinks reception which will be right outside, to which everyone is invited. It remains for me to, again, to thank the Green Templeton College, the powers that be in the Maths Building for allowing us to use this space, very much the trustees for this fantastic institution that has been set up, to you all for coming, to Vince and Roger as co-panelists, but above all to you, Abhijit, and we wish you well for the rest of your Oxford visit. Thank you very much.
Thank you.